Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. We promised you we'd be bringing some interesting thought leaders to our conversations. And today we have one that Deborah has arranged with Daryl Davis. I think that's going to be very illuminating and enlightening, in particular on our conversational skills. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation. Deborah, why don't you introduce Daryl and tell us why you've selected him to join us?
Well, thank you, David. I can't tell you how excited I am to welcome Daryl to our call today. For the musicians here, Daryl's played with the likes of Chuck Berry, B.B. King, Jerry Lee Lewis, and that's cool enough in itself, but he's also been doing something that strikes me as a little short of amazing. And when I first heard about him, I just thought, oh my gosh, I've got to meet this person. He's been having conversations with members of the Ku Klux Klan that have inspired something like 200 of them to leave the Klan. So something you said, Daryl, in your talk to Google about, so what are you doing about it, was a real call to action to me. So Daryl's got a multicultural background, growing up in the Foreign Service, living and traveling with his parents all over the world. Whatever it is that he's got, I want to know more about his secret of how he has these conversations, and we get them all to ourselves. Over to you, Daryl.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, David. Well, as Deborah pointed out, I have done a lot of traveling, and I will just start with my favorite quote of all time. It's by Mark Twain, called the travel quote. And Mark Twain said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." And that is so true. I am age 63, and I first started traveling in 1961 at the age of three with my parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I grew up as an American embassy brat, living in different countries for 2 years, coming back home, being here in the States for a few months, and then to another foreign country for 2 years. So when you combine my childhood travels with my parents, now with my adulthood travels as a professional musician who plays all over this country and around the world, I have now been in a total of 57 countries on 6 continents, and I will perform in my 50th state later this month. But all that is to say is that I have been exposed to a multitude of religions, skin colors, ethnicities, cultures, belief systems, ideologies, you name it. And all of that has helped shape who I've become. Now, let me say this, that does not make me a better human being than somebody else. But what it has given me is a better and broader perspective of humanity than most people who have not seen those things. And that's what I try to bring in my conversations and my music and my communications with people who may not have been exposed to those things. So I can tell you something that, you know, that I've learned and I've put into my own little personal toolbox, which I'm very happy to share with you. And that is this, that no matter how far I have gone from my own country right here, the US, whether it's right next door to Canada or to Mexico or halfway around the globe, no matter how different anybody may be who I encounter, who don't look like me, don't speak like me, don't worship like me, or whatever, I always conclude one thing, that we all are human beings. And as such, everybody that I've met pretty much all want these same 5 core values. Yeah, you know, there are more, but these are the 5 main ones that, you know, that I've chosen for today. We all want to be loved. We all want to be respected. We all want to be heard. We want to be treated fairly. And we all want the same things for our family as anybody else wants for their family. We all want our families to thrive, and mostly better than we thrived ourselves. Our parents want more for their kids than they had, and so forth and so on. So I've learned that if we apply those 5 values or any of those values, when we find ourselves in an adversarial situation, or we find ourselves in a culture or society in which we are unfamiliar, and we apply those values, I can guarantee you that your navigation will be much more positive and much more smooth. And those are the values that I've been applying when I've been dealing with KKK members, neo-Nazis, the alt-right Proud Boys, and whoever else, you know, that I encounter, white supremacists, or just, you know, the racist next door who doesn't want you dating his daughter or something, but doesn't belong to any organized group. And I've had a great deal of success. There will always be those people who will go to their grave being hateful, racist, violent, destructive, anti-Semitic, and all that. But even those people, if they take the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation, there is an opportunity for you to plant a seed. But you always must come back and water that seed and nurture it until it blooms and they can stand on their own with that transition. And that's what I've been doing. You're on mute, David.
Thank you, Daryl. Thank you, Daryl. Yes, amazing. One of the things that I was noticed in your work is that you naturally communicated with people along the way. And people would come up and talk with you and share with you. You share in one of the videos a story of meeting one of the Ku Klux Klan members for the very first time. And I'm curious, what brought the gift of just being able to connect and talk with people and not being afraid of people? You also talked about growing up and being attacked at the age of 10 and not really understanding racism to that point. So I'm just curious, do you think it's your growing up around the world? Do you think it was how you're raised? But there's a innocence and a curiosity to you. And I'm just curious what the seeds of that are in you.
I think all three. You know, the way I was raised, my curiosity, and growing up around the world. You know, let me just give just a little bit of background for your group here. My first exposure to school was overseas. I lived in Africa for 10 years. I lived in Europe. And I was born in 58. I went overseas at the age of three in 1961. You're there for 2 years, come back home, and 2 years of somewhere else. So I did kindergarten, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, seventh grade overseas. And my first exposure to school was overseas. My classmates were from all over the world. Anybody who had an embassy in those particular countries to which we were assigned, all of their kids were in the same school. So my classmates were from Nigeria, Italy, Germany, France, Sweden, Japan, Russia, Czechoslovakia, you name it. If they had an embassy there, their kids were in my school. And so that became my baseline. I was around all these people and we all got along. You know, we worked together, we played together, we had slumber parties together. Even if we didn't speak the same language or look alike, we all learned how to get along and play together, work together. And so that's how I grew up. When I would return home here to my own country, you know, every couple of years in the 60s, I was either in all black schools or black and white schools, meaning the still segregated or newly integrated. Even though desegregation was passed by the Supreme Court in 1954, you know, schools just, you know, didn't just integrate overnight. You know, first you have desegregation, and then you have, you know, which happens overnight, but then it takes integration years to finally integrate. And so, you know, I was not, you know, for me, if you all remember, because I'm looking around here at your faces, and I'm sure most of you remember black and white TV. And then, you know, when color TV came in, it was like, wow, you know, I love this. Well, I had kind of a reverse, because going to school overseas was color TV. When I came back home, it was black and white, because we didn't have the diversity in my classroom that I had overseas, or that we have today. Today, you walk into a classroom, people are from all over, et cetera. But it wasn't like that, as you recall, back in the 60s. So I didn't understand that. And I was so used to dealing with different cultures and different people I just viewed white supremacy as just a different culture, you know, and I want to learn about it. So it wasn't anything for me to be afraid of. Yes, I was aware, you know, that these people had, you know, had done some terrible things, or people associated with them from their past or wherever had made some, you know, major atrocities in this country. But I was curious as to why they thought that way. And you mentioned an incident that I had at the age of 10, when some people threw some rocks and bottles at me while I was marching in a Cub Scout parade as the only Black participant. That caused me to come up with a question, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And I've been looking for that answer for the next 53 years, because I was age 10 then, and I'm 63 now. And so who better to ask that question of than someone who would go so far as to join an organization that practices hating people who don't look like them and who don't believe as they believe. So I began seeking out KKK members and sitting them down and talking with them. You know, those who would talk to me. There were those who would not talk to me. There were those who wanted to fight me, physically attack me and things like that. And I had to deal with that. But, you know, I've been doing this work now for 37 years in between my music gigs. And I've noticed that diplomacy is the key, and applying those five core values will take you a long way, even in with people who detest you for no other reason than the color of your skin.
I'm curious, when you first have a conversation with a Klan member for the first time, what's your design for that conversation? What's the architecture in your head? What are you thinking about? What's your first question?
Well, my first question is, why? Why did you join the Ku Klux Klan? And, you know, these people are not necessarily monolithic. They're monolithic in their belief that they don't like Jews, they don't like Blacks, they don't like gay people, they don't like that, you know, whatever. But there are different reasons for why they join. A Klansman or Klanswoman is not stamped out of a standard cookie cutter. They come from all different walks of life. And, you know, if most people, you know, see them on tabloid TV shows like Geraldo, Jerry Springer, and they're up there yelling and using racial epithets and throwing chairs and all that kind of stuff. And yes, I know a lot of those people, but they also go from third grade dropout to college graduate to president of the United States. President Warren G. Harding was sworn into the Ku Klux Klan in the green room of the White House. President Harry Truman was a Klan member before he became president. He joined for a little while. He didn't like it. He got out. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black was in the Ku Klux Klan when he got appointed to the Supreme Court. He had to leave the Klan in order to become a Supreme Court justice. Senator Robert Byrd, who was our oldest living senator, who passed away a few years ago from West Virginia, he was a Klansman in the 1940s. He later saw the light and renounced all that stuff. So, you know, it goes from all educational backgrounds, all different walks of life. So my thing is to find out why, what was the motivation? And then that can determine what route I take in my conversation. Sometimes people join because my grandfather was in the Klan, my daddy was in the Klan, I'm in the Klan, and my kids are gonna be in the Klan. So it's a family tradition passed down. Others join because they move into an area or they grew up in an area that is like a Klan stronghold, you know, a good old boys network. The Klan dominates that town, like East Texas or somewhere like that. And so, you know, if you wanna get along in that town and do business, you know, you join the local Chamber of Commerce, the local country club, and the local KKK, you know, and that, you know, is your entree. Others join it for economic reasons. For example, you take a depressed town, let's say a coal mining town, and, you know, you and your family have worked in that coal mine, digging coal for generations. That's the first thing you do when you come out of high school. You go to the coal mine, you dig coal. And that's all you know. You get married and have kids and they go to the coal mine. Then the company gets this bright idea that, hey, you know what? We can save a lot of money. Let's lay off these guys. And these are mostly white workers. Let's lay them off and hire some of these immigrants. You know, we don't care. We don't care if they're legal or illegal, because we can pay them this much. And we're already paying these white guys that much, so we can save money. So they lay off these white workers who were never racist to begin with. They're happy. You know, they're happy. They're digging their coal. They're making their money. They're paying their bills. They're supporting their family. You know, they don't care about what religion you are, or what color you are. But now they're being laid off and they're out of work and they don't qualify for any other job because all they know is digging coal. They don't know anything else. So the Klan will come into an area, a depressed area like that. I've seen it in West Virginia. I've seen it in Pennsylvania and other places. They will come into a place like that and hold a rally and say, hey, you know, the blacks have the NAACP, the Jews have the ADL. Nobody stands up for the white man but the Ku Klux Klan. You know, your job's not gone, but you're gone. And some, and they use some epithet for a Hispanic person or a black person, some such and such has your job. You can't even put food on your family's table. You can't put clothes on your kid's back. Come join the Klan. We'll get your job back. Now, these people who were never racist to begin with, they're out of work. The bank is knocking on their door for their mortgage or whatever. And they can't afford it, you know, and they don't have any other job. So they're in despair and they're like, you know, what do I have to lose? You know, sign me up. And so that's their entrance into white supremacy. So they come from all different walks of life. And until you figure out what was the motivation behind their being in it, it gives you more tools to direct, you know, your questions and your conversation that, you know, that will make them think.
Fascinating. How have you changed your conversational strategy over the years? You said you've been doing this work for 37 years. You've told the story about meeting the first Klansman. What have you refined or changed as you've asked questions and learned more and been more curious?
I think I have refined my beliefs or totally revamped my beliefs because, you know, we all have heard the adages growing up. As kids, a tiger does not change his stripes. A leopard does not change his spots. We all have heard those things, and we believe that. And so I was thinking, well, a Klansman doesn't change his robe and hood. He is who he is, you know? And I never set out, and this is where the media gets me wrong pretty often. I never set out, and even today, to convert anybody. I just set out to find out why. Why do you think this way? And because initially, I never believed the Klansman was going to change. I never believed that I would ever become friends with somebody who was in the Ku Klux Klan. You know, that's crazy. And, you know, so all I want to know is, why do you do this? Why do you think this way? And then I'm done with you. Because I was writing a book, you know, so I'm interviewing all these Klan people up north, down south, Midwest and West, all over this country. And I'm going to put it in my book that I, you know, that I was writing at the time, which is now out. But I never set out to convert anybody. And through the course of conversation, and here's what's interesting. When you ask these people a question, they don't reciprocate initially because I have nothing to offer them. I'm inferior. I'm a black person. I am their nemesis. You know, they are a supremacist. So therefore, you know, I'm the inferior one, they're the superior one in their mind. So I have nothing to give them. So it's like, you know, if I say to you, so David, you know, what do you think about Joe Biden's policy on this or Donald Trump's policy on that? You're going to tell me what you think. And then you're going to say, well, Daryl, what do you think? So it'll be a back and forth. They don't do that with somebody who they despise, you know, whether it's a Jew or a black or whatever, because that person is inferior. They have nothing to offer me. So they'll answer all the questions. And this might go on for a few weeks, may go on for a few months. And then suddenly out of the blue, you ask a question and they'll say, well, you know, they'll tell you the answer as best they can. And then they'll say, well, what do you think? It's like, whoa, yeah. You know, all of a sudden I have some little modicum of value. So it's always important that when you answer a question that they ask you, that you be very transparent and be very clear as to whether you're stating a fact or you're stating an opinion. You know, if they, you know, because you don't want to give your opinion as a fact if it could be possibly wrong, because they will hold that against you forever. So, but if you have a fact that can be proven, you give it to them. Always be truthful, because what you come to find out is this: one of the most important things that I've learned, while you are actively seeking information from somebody else, they are passively gleaning information from you. So, you know, if you're not transparent and there's any reason for them to distrust you, you become persona non grata immediately. So, you know, when you get asked a question, always be truthful. Say, hey, listen, I know this for a fact, you know, and here's where you can find that out and prove my point. Or, you know what, this is my opinion. You know, this is what I think. You know, people may disagree with me. So some people do agree with me. It's simply an opinion. And you tell them what you think. And that will elevate your respect with them. And then they'll start asking you more questions. And you don't realize it. But they begin thinking about this stuff. And they go home and they look it up and research it and find out. And then when they realize what you told them makes sense or is true, and they've gone down the wrong road, they begin having a cognitive dissonance. It's like, you know, what that Black person or that Jewish person said is true. Oh, but he's a Jew, or he's Black. Yeah, but it's true. Oh, but he's a Jew, or he's Black, you know, whatever. They struggle with that. And they have to eventually come to terms and decide, do I disregard that person's skin color or his or her religion and believe what they said to be true because I know it's true, and now I must change my ideological direction? Or do I consider their religion or skin color and continue living a lie? Most people will follow the truth, but there will be those who will follow the lie.
Two questions related to this. How do you keep your focus knowing that you're speaking into people that oftentimes have inaccurate information or inaccurate beliefs? And how do you, answer that one first and I'll get you the second part in a second.
Well, because, you know, I've seen the answer already that they have yet to see. So that's what I'm focused on. You know, they don't believe integration works, that people cannot get along. You know, you have what are called white supremacists, and you have what are called white separatists. And the difference being, a white separatist believes, okay, Blacks can have their own workplaces, their own neighborhoods, their own restaurants, their own schools, their own swimming pool, and all that. And Jews can have theirs. And we should be able to have ours. So that way, you know, separate but equal kind of thing. And some extreme separatists like David Duke, for example, you know, he took a map of the United States and divvied it up. You know, New York and down to DC was for the Jews, and DC down to Mississippi was for the Blacks. The whole Pacific Northwest is for the whites. You know, all this kind of crazy nonsense. You know, that's an extreme separatist. A white supremacist believes this is a white man's country. We founded this country, we signed the Constitution, you know, we made all the advancements in this country, and any non-whites need to go back to where they came from or be eliminated. That's a white supremacist. And so, you know, they don't believe that we can get along together, whether you're a separatist or a supremacist. I know we can, because I've seen it, I've lived it. You know, so I have the answer that they have yet to see, and that's how I maintain my focus.
And what are the meta lessons just about communication in general? It may apply to your music, it may apply to these conversations, but what have you learned about communication through all of this?
Okay, listening is very, very key. You know, like I said, everybody wants to be heard as one of those tools in the toolbox. You cannot expect anyone to listen to you unless you hear them out. And you know, when you first, and this applies, folks, to anything, you know, not just race. In fact, we can take race off the table momentarily here. There are a lot of other hot topics in the air today. Abortion, global warming, the last presidential election, the war in the Middle East, climate control, you know, whatever. Those are all hot topics. You're on one side, somebody else is on the other side. Listen, listen to your adversary, because when they come in the room to talk to you, their wall goes automatically goes up because you are the opponent. So their hackles are up, you know, they're ready to defend at all costs, whatever their position is. When you frame the get together, do not frame it as a debate. You know, we're here to debate, blah, blah, blah. No, as soon as you use that word debate, it changes somebody's psychological mindset. You know, they're ready to fight, they're ready to defend, you know. So just say, we're here to have a conversation and exchange our ideas. That keeps the temperature kind of down because their temperature is already up when they see you because you are the inferior and they are the superior. And their ears are blocked to anything that you're going to say to them that goes counter to what they believe. So in order to unblock their ears and for you to impart information that gets inside their ears, you have to lower the temperature and lower their wall because they come in with that wall up. All right, so just talking to them when the wall is up is like hitting a brick wall. So you do it first by listening to them and showing them that respect. Understand, when I'm sitting there listening to them and they're offending me, telling me how bad I am because of my skin color, you know, I'm a criminal, blacks are prone to crime, we're criminals, we're lazy, we want to scam the government welfare system. Black people are born with smaller brains than white people. You know, the larger the brain, the more capacity for intelligence. The smaller the brain, the lower the IQ. I'm sitting there face to face with somebody sitting 2 feet in front of me, telling me this, basically calling me a criminal, telling me that I'm lazy, and telling me that I'm stupid. And they're evidencing this, say, Black people are prone to crime. They evidence that by the fact that they say, you know, Mr. Davis, there are more Black people in prison than white people. So what the person is telling me is true. There are more Blacks in prison than white people. When they see that, and the data shows that, it supports their already racist narrative. They don't bother to look any further to find that maybe more Black people are in prison than white people for the same crime because of the imbalance in our judicial system. They don't go that far. All they need is that information, you know, on the surface. When they tell me that that Black people are born with smaller brains than white people, and they tell me that is evidenced by the fact that every year Black students, high school students, score lower on the SATs than white kids. Again, that is true, you know, on the whole. And the data and these statistics show that, and that's all they need. They don't dig deeper to find out why. Well, reason being, where do most Black kids in our country go to school? In the inner city. Where do most white kids go to school? In the suburbs. It is a fact that inner city schools are not as up to snuff as suburban schools are. There's a lower quality of teaching, you know, facilities, et cetera. I can guarantee you that Black kids who go to school in the suburbs can score just as high, if not higher, than some of those white kids. White kids who go to school in the inner city can score just as low, if not lower, than some of those Black kids. It has absolutely nothing to do with the student's brain size or skin color, but has everything to do with the educational system in which that child is enrolled. But see, they don't bother to look at that portion because the stats support what they already believe. So basically, I'm sitting there hearing all this. Is what they're saying offensive? Absolutely, it's offensive. Am I offended by it? Absolutely not. And why am I not offended by it? Because it does not apply to me. I know who I am. I'm not going to let some guy walk into the room who's only known me for 5 minutes and tell me that I'm dumb and I'm a criminal and I'm lazy. And he assumes that all because of the color of my skin. So we need to keep our egos behind us. We know who we are. If you don't know who you are, you have no business walking into a room with your adversary because they will tell you who you are and you might walk out of there believing them. So know who you are going in. You know, be open-minded and show the respect of listening to them. Now, when I say respect, understand something. I'm respecting the person who is sitting there calling me a criminal and lazy and dumb. Understand this. I am not respecting what he is saying. I am simply respecting his right to say it. And that's where a lot of people get confused. So you're going to hear all kinds of stuff, but it's worth hearing, because as you listen to these people, you are showing them that respect. Their temperature is coming down and their ears are opening. And by the time they get done exhausting all their vitriol, they're ready to listen to you, because they're wondering, how come this guy isn't pushing back? Because they're used to pushback. You know, they've been doing that for a long time, insulting people. So number one, they're curious why you're not pushing back. And number two, they feel compelled to reciprocate, because after all, you listen to them. Now, you know, they're going to listen to you. So now it's the time to impart whatever it is you have to say to them when you have lowered their wall. Now, it's my turn to talk, and I can rebut what, you know, what they say. Now, I can rebut it by going on the offense. No, you are the criminal. You and your people who wear those stupid robes and hoods hang Black people from trees. You bomb Black churches. You drag them behind pickup trucks and all this kind of stuff. And I would be 100% correct. The Klan has a 156-year history of doing just that, all right? But if I went on the offense like that, what would happen? That wall would go right back up and the ears would plug. I want my message to sink in. So rather than go on the offense, I go on the defense. And I say, listen, I'm as Black as anybody you've ever seen. I don't have a criminal record. I've never been on welfare. My parents have never been on welfare. As far as my brain size goes, I've never measured my brain size, but I'm sure it's the same size as anybody else's. And as far as my SATs go, my SATs got me into college. I have a bachelor's degree in music. My parents both had master's degrees. My dad was working on his PhD before he passed away. So I've already done my research on this person sitting across from me. This guy barely made it out of high school, but I don't throw that in his face. I just defend what my accomplishments. And that way he hears what I'm saying. And then he thinks about it later at home. And he may struggle with it for a few days, a week, a month, maybe two or three months. And then he makes a decision, because he has to decide, I know now what is true. Do I disregard the person's religion or skin color and accept the truth? Or do I consider it came from a Black person or a Jewish person and I continue living a lie?
Such helpful, clear advice. Many of us have clients who are having harder and harder conversations in their world, where we've become a much more complex world just in the last few years. People are going to be gathering for holidays over the next couple months and having interesting conversations with family members.
You know, David,
you want to add to that?
You know, yeah. Listen, I know all about that from friends of mine. You know, I cannot go to Thanksgiving dinner with my family because my sister voted for this person and I voted for that person. And we can't even talk across the table. And, you know, so I'm just not going to Thanksgiving, or I'm not getting together with my best friend for Christmas because, you know, their whole family does this or does that. Listen, I'm a Black guy. If I can go to a Klan rally and talk to those people and end up with their robes and hoods, and I have quite a collection of robes and hoods and swastika flags and all kinds of stuff given to me by people who are active in the neo-Nazi movement and the Ku Klux Klan, who have now renounced all that due to the conversations I've had with them. If I can go to that extreme, you people can sit down with your family members and have these conversations. That is mild compared to going to a Nazi rally or a Klan rally. And let me remind you of something. Whoever is president is only gonna be there for 4 years at the minimum, 8 years at the maximum. And then they're gone. You have been with your family for decades. So are you going to throw away decades over somebody who's only sitting in office for 4 or 8 years? No, You know, think about it that way. Have these conversations, you know, and be honest. Don't attack them. And another thing I want to add about communication, because you asked about, you know, things that, that I've come to learn, is this. We all know that one's perception is one's reality. We need to keep that in mind. So do not attack anybody's reality. That is a recipe for disaster. That is a recipe for antagonism and adversity, okay? Even if you know their reality is wrong, don't attack it. It's their reality, and to them, it's real because that's what they perceive. One's perception is one's reality. So if you want to effect change, here's what you do. Think up some better perceptions and offer them better perceptions. And if they resonate with one of your perceptions, they will then change their own reality because their perception becomes their reality. All right, so I'll give you a hypothetical example. Let's say you have a 7 or 8 year old son or brother, and he goes to a magic show with his buddy and his buddy's parents. And he comes home and tells you, you know, this magician on stage, he asked for a female volunteer and, you know, 50 women raised their hand, and he pointed to one of them and told her to come up on stage. And she came up on stage and he put the microphone in her face and asked her where she was from and what her name was and so on. And then he asked her to climb inside this long box and stick her feet out the hole at that end and stick her head out the hole at this end. And then when she did that, he closed the lid. And they took a chainsaw and went and cut that box in half. He cut that woman in half. And you try to tell him, well, no, he didn't exactly do that. Yes, he did. I was there. I saw him. You weren't even there. I saw it with my own eyes. Okay? To him, it was real. That was his perception. And you cannot attack his reality. He knows what he saw. And furthermore, you weren't even there. So you didn't see it. He saw the man cut the woman in half. And to make it even more evident that he did this, your son or brother tells you, and then when he did this, he took the half of the box with the feet sticking out and moved it over here to stage right, and the box with the half with the head over here to stage left. And then he went over and talked to the head of the woman, and the woman's head talked back to him. And then he took the two halves and brought them back together and opened the lid, and the woman came out full form, no blood. He cut her in half and he put her back together. That is his perception and that is his reality. And if you say, well, you know, it's an illusion. No, it's not. I'm telling you, I saw it. Okay, so don't attack his reality. All you're going to do is defeat your purpose. You're going to hit that brick wall. What you do is you offer that 7 or 8 year old kid a better perception. You say to him, hey, listen, I hear what you're saying, but is it possible that just maybe out of those 50 women that volunteered when he asked for a volunteer, that one that he chose, is it maybe possible that she works for him? She knows the trick. He planted her in the audience and she travels all around the country with him as his assistant. And so when she comes up on stage, you don't realize it. She already works for him. She knows the trick. She gets inside the box. There's already a pair of mannequin legs laying on the floor of the box that are wearing the same stockings and shoes that she has on. She picks them up with her hand and slides them out the hole at the end of the box. And then she brings her own legs up under her chest and puts her head out the other hole. So her whole body is on that half of the box. So the saw never touches her when it goes through. And when he separates the boxes, all that's over there is a half a box with a pair of dummy legs. But the dummy legs don't move like human legs do. So he diverts your attention from the legs over here to this side of the stage to the head. And he talks to the head and the head is talking back, and that's keeping your attention focused there as opposed to these dummy legs. Because, you know, there's animation going on here. The woman's whole body is over there. And then when he brings the two halves back together, she simply pulls the legs out of the hole and lets them lay on the floor of the box, and she climbs out. And then your kid says, you know, I guess that would be the only way that could work. So you've offered him a better perception, and he changes his own reality. That is always better than trying to force your reality upon somebody else.
That's a great example, Daryl. Thank you so much. Regina, you've got a number of questions. Pick one that you'd like to ask Daryl.
Sure. Thank you for that example. So I guess the first question that I was wondering is, in all of the, you've been doing this for so long, so in all of the conversations that you've had, what has been the most surprising turnaround that you have seen? Maybe you started and the person was one way, and after years, you kind of came back and revisited and noticed there was a shift. And I'd love to know the catalyst or what's been most surprising for you.
I've had a lot of those, Regina, in the 37 years that I've been doing this. I'll give you a couple of them. A Klan leader that I knew very well was murdered a few years ago. I knew him very well. I knew the murderer very well. I knew his whole family. I've been to his home many times and knew his kids, his dog, you know, and I went to the funeral and I participated in the funeral. There were two funerals, one for the public and one private one for the Klan. And because this guy was close to me, the Klan invited me to their private funeral as well. So I attended both funerals and I played some hymns on the keyboard, on the piano at the funeral. And, you know, they were very touched by that. And so later on that year, they invited me, the new leader invited me to come to a Klan meeting and rally. And I've been to a bunch of them, you know, already, but they invited me to come to this meeting and talk to them. So I stood up there addressing all these men and women in their Klan robes and hoods. And I told them, I said, you know, this guy who was murdered, you know, your leader, he was not killed by a Black person. He was not killed by some rival Klansman or the police or whatever. He was killed by somebody very close to him, a fellow, you know, Klan member. And I said, you know, when you peddle in hate, you put it out into the world, it will come back and bite you. It may not come back from who you think it might come back from. It may not come back from the people that you hate on, because karma works in mysterious ways. It may come back from somebody who you love or somewhere else, somebody you would least expect. But you put it out there, it's going to come back. You reap what you sow. And, you know, I imparted that message to them, and about two or three people out of that group quit. And I now have their robes and hoods. I'll tell you a funny one. This Klansman was riding around in my car. We do a lot of that, have conversations in my car. Anyway, he brought up this thing that I've heard a number of times over the years, that we're talking about crime. He said, you know, Black people have a gene within us that makes us prone to crime. And sort of like the other guy was telling me about, you know, Blacks are prone to crime. You see it by all the Blacks in the prison. Well, I said to this guy, so, you know, what do you mean by that? He says, well, you all have to have this gene that just makes you violent and prone to crime. I said, well, give me an example. And he says, and he's sitting over here in my passenger seat and I'm driving. And he says, well, who's doing all the drive-bys and carjackings in Southeast? He was referring to Southeast Washington, D.C., which is predominantly Black and very high crime ridden. There's some whites who live there, but it's predominantly Black and very high crime ridden. I said, okay, so it's Black people. I said, but you know, you're not considering the demographics. That's what lives there. I said, who's doing all the crime in Bangor, Maine? White people, because that's what lives in Bangor. You know, you're not considering the demographics. Oh, no, that has nothing to do with it. You know, you all got that gene. I said, look here, man. I said, I'm Black. I said, I have never done a drive-by or a carjacking. How do you explain that? This Klansman did not hesitate one second. He answered me like that. He said, your gene is latent. It hasn't come out yet. How do you argue with somebody who is that far out in left field? I just sat there dumbfounded, you know, like, what? You know, my gene almost came out, but you know, I'm just sitting there dumbfounded. How do you answer that? He's over here sitting all smug and secure, like, you see, you know, you got nothing to say about that. And so I thought about it. Okay, so now I have to go to where he is. So I said to him, I said, well, you know, all white people have a gene within them that makes them a serial killer. He says, how do you figure? I said, name me three Black serial killers. He couldn't do it. I said, here, I'll give you one. I named one for him. I said, just name me two. He couldn't do it. I said, John Wayne Gacy, Henry Lee Lucas, Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, Ted Bundy, Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, on and on. I said, they're all white. I said, son, you are a serial killer. He says, Daryl, I never killed anybody. I said, your gene is latent, hasn't come out yet. He goes, well, that's stupid. I said, well, duh. I said, you're right, it is stupid. But it's no more stupid for me to say that about you than what you said about me. And he got very, very quiet. But I could see his wheels were like spinning, you know, smoke coming out. And he changed the subject. You know, we started talking again. And within 5 months, that guy quit the Klan. His robe was the first robe that I ever got. Based on that conversation, I did not attack his reality. I simply gave him another analogy, another perception.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
So, Daryl, I know we only have you for a couple more minutes, a number of other great questions in chat. The last one, and this is Michelle's question, our focus is really on learning and development. And what's at the edge of your learning curve right now? What are you studying? What's got your interest today?
Well, I'm working on a project right now that I'm not ready to reveal just yet, but you can be sure, just like me, it'll be different, but it will also be benevolent to other people. And I would love to come back and once it's complete and share it with everybody.
Love to have you back. And lastly, we haven't talked about your music much, and we care about music in this course as well. And I'm just curious, how do you think about your music with all this other work that you're doing? How do they blend together for you? Where do they intersect in your head?
Okay, well, I'll give you three little short stories here. You know, my degree is in jazz, but I play country, blues, rock and roll, swing, you know, whatever. I love rock and roll music. I'm talking about the original rock and roll. Chuck Berry. I worked for Chuck Berry for 32 years, played piano for him. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Fats Domino, you know, the original rockers. And back in the day, before I was born, you know, music halls, concert venues were segregated. If they allowed Black people in at all, there were ropes going around the seating sections with signs hanging down that would say seating for white patrons only or colored seating only. You know, same as you saw the water fountains or the restrooms, things like that. So David, if you and I were to go see, let's say in the 1940s, we wanted to go see the Glenn Miller Orchestra or Frank Sinatra or somebody, you and I would not be able to sit together. That was the law. And if you broke the law, you get arrested, just like Rosa Parks and the bus incident. It was a stupid law. It never should have been enacted, but it was the law. And she refused to give up her seat to a white man, and the police arrested her. Okay? So that same Jim Crow law Back in the 40s and stuff, people did not break the law. You know, if whites and blacks went to a concert, they sat separately and nobody crossed sat. In the 1950s, that same law was still in effect. But two phenomenons happened. Rock and roll was created by the black originators, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley, Fats Domino, and popularized by the great white artists like Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Buddy Holly, Bill Haley in the Comets, and others. But that's number one. Number two, when those people came out on stage playing this new beat, because people were accustomed to swing, and now you're hearing boom, boom, bap, boom, boom, bap, boom, boom, bap, with that backbeat. White kids and black kids could not sit still. And for the first time in our musical history in this country, black kids and white kids bounced up out of their segregated seating sections, flailing around, knocking the signs down and the ropes down, and they were dancing and boogieing in the aisles together for the first time in American history. And understand something, these black kids and white kids dancing together, think about this. They did not even know each other. They did not even know each other because they did not go to school together in the 1950s. They went to separate high schools, right? They were segregated. Blacks lived on one side of the tracks, whites on the other. They might recognize somebody walking down the street. Oh, I've seen him before. But they were never friends with these people. And now they're dancing with these people. So the police would come in and shut down these concerts because they were race mixing. And that was illegal. So, you know, we give a lot of credit, and deservedly so, to the black and white adults who worked in the civil rights movement from 1955 on through the 60s, working hard through marches, protests, boycotts, sit-ins, demonstrations to bring white adults and black adults together. These rock and roll artists, Chuck, Richard, Jerry Lee, Elvis, they were achieving that with black and white youth through their music. So we have to give these early rock and rollers credit for that civil rights move of bringing whites and black kids together through music. So that's why I love rock and roll. Now, as a band leader, my job on stage is to blend the voices of my band, whether it's the instrumental voices, piano, bass, drums, guitar, saxophone, or the vocal voices. I want to blend them in harmony with each other. The only time I want, or anybody, the only time we want dissonance in our music is when we intentionally inject it into the music for effect. Because if there's some dissonance random happening in a song, that's not music. That's somebody hit a bad note or sang flat or sang sharp, you know, unintentional. That's noise. That's not music. It's only music when you intentionally inject this dissonance into your composition for effect. So as a band leader, my job is to bring harmony between the voices on my stage. When I finish my gig and I step off that stage and now I'm out in society, I still want harmony. I want harmony around the people who are around me in society. So that's where that music, you know, gives me that passion for harmony, whether it's on stage or whether it's blending in conversations with people. And then lastly, I'll say this. Let's say I'm off this Friday night, you know, and I spent the last month entertaining people with my band. So now I want to be entertained. So I'm off. I'm going to go out and hear a band or you know, I want to go out dancing or something. So there's a bar down the street or a club down the street. I go there, it's either a DJ playing music or some band's playing music. I want to dance. There are people on the dance floor and it's a good song. And so I look around to see if I see a single woman, unattached, you know, that might want to dance with me. And I see Regina sitting at the bar and she's patting her hand on the bar in time to the music, right? So obviously she likes that song. Now, I don't know Regina, but she's by herself. She likes the song. I'm going to walk over there and say, hey, you know, would you care to dance? And she says, yeah, sure. She hops off her bar stool and we go out on the dance floor. Now, if it's a slow song, she and I are like this, you know, slowly turning around on the floor. If it's a fast song, we're apart, we're shaking and whatever. And then at the end of the song, I escort her back to her seat at the bar. I say, thank you for the dance. By the way, my name is Daryl. And I shake her hand and she says, my name's Regina. And I say, so what do you do, Regina? And Regina tells me she's the vice president of marketing for Microsoft on the East Coast. Well, she's probably making $500,000 a year. And she says, you know, what do you do, Daryl? And I say, I'm a cashier at McDonald's. So what am I making? I'm making maybe $9,000 or $10,000 a year. Where do two people at those opposite ends of the spectrum come this close? Music brought us together. Because everybody likes music. It is a universal language. And lastly, I just gave you a hypothetical example. I'll give you a real example. I played in a country band back in the day. And we played a place called the Silver Dollar Lounge in Frederick, Maryland, about an hour and 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. The Silver Dollar Lounge was known as an all-white lounge. Black people were not welcome. There were no signs that said that, but it had that reputation. And I'd never been there before. I was the only black guy in the band. The band had played there before. They're pretty well established here in the Maryland area. And so I just joined the band. Here I am in the Silver Dollar Lounge. And we just finished our first set of music. We're taking a break and I'm going to go sit down at the table. And I feel somebody come up from behind and put their arm across my shoulder. I don't know anybody in this place other than the band. And I see the whole band in front of me walking towards the table. I'm following them. And I turn around to see who's touching me. It's this white guy, older than me. And he has a big smile on his face. And he says, man, I sure like your all's music. And I said, thank you. And I shook his hand. And he pointed at the stage and said, I've seen this here band before, but I ain't never seen you before. Where'd you come from? And I explained to him, yes, you have seen the band because they've played here before. I said, but this is my first time here. I just joined the band. And he says, well, man, I sure like your piano playing. This is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, I was not offended, but I was surprised that given the fact that he was older than me, that he did not know the black origin of Jerry Lee Lewis's piano style. And I proceeded to tell him it came from black, blues, and boogie-woogie piano players. That's where rock and roll and rockabilly evolved. Well, he didn't believe that. And I said, look, I know Jerry Lee Lewis. Jerry Lee is a good friend of mine. He's told me himself where he learned to play. He didn't believe that I knew Jerry Lee either. But he was so fascinated with me, he invited me back to his table and wanted to buy me a drink. So I let him buy me a cranberry juice. He pays the waitress and he clinks my glass with his glass and cheers me and says, you know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man. And now I'm baffled because at that point in my life, I had sat down literally with thousands of white people or anybody else and had a meal, a beverage, a conversation. How is it that this guy older than me had never done that? And innocently, I asked him why. And at first he didn't answer me. I asked him again, he was staring down at the tabletop. And his buddy sitting next to him elbowed him and said, tell him. And I said, tell me. He looked back at me and said, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And I burst out laughing at him because I didn't believe him. And then he went inside his pocket, put out his wallet and handed me his Klan card. I recognized the Klan emblem, a red circle with a white cross and red blood drop. It was for real. I stopped laughing and I gave it back to him. But he was very friendly, very nice, and he gave me his phone number, wanted me to call him whenever I was to come back to this bar. And so that's the power of music. And today, you know, that guy, well, he's passed on since then. But he and I became friends, and I got some of his Klan stuff. As a result of that conversation, that never would have happened had it been music. I can guarantee you, if I just walked into that bar just to go out dancing, and nothing but white women in there, I would have had to fight my way out.
Thank you so much. Fantastic stories, great illustrations. I think we're all far better equipped to have challenging, difficult conversations. You shared with us some really essential pieces. Deborah, any final words before we let Daryl go?
Just thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have met you. You welcomed me when I reached out to you not knowing anything about me and engaged in a conversation with me.
That's what conversations do.
One of my heroes.
Okay, thank you all. Take good care.
Thanks Bye-bye. So much, Daryl. Really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.